Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor at the EU summit in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungo, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic has been assessing the latest negotiations in Brussels and all the politics in London and Dublin.
This week, well, where to begin? It all started on Monday with Theresa May pulling the meaningful vote on the withdrawal agreement from the House of Commons.
In the explosion and anger that followed, hardline Tory Brexiteers seized the moment to launch a dramatic no-confidence motion.
As her enemies were plotting, Mrs. May went on a madcap dash around Europe, The Hague, Berlin, Brussels, desperately seeking some goodwill for something, anything on the Irish backstop, maybe some kind of legal guarantees that it would not last forever.
She flew back to London and straight into a no-confidence motion, which she won with 200 MPs supporting her.
But 117 voting against her, not a convincing victory and a sign that the gambit had solved nothing except to deepen the divisions within the Tory party.
So, weakened and humiliated, Mrs. May yesterday travelled back to Brussels for what turned out to be more humiliation and an unseemly row over what the word nebulous means. So, Tony, let's go back to Monday.
Yes, Colin. Well, what a week it's been. Monday, of course, a lot of anticipation and controversy and general excitement over the meaningful vote, which, of course, was scheduled for Tuesday, the 11th of December. This would be the moment for Theresa May to put the withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons. To ratify it, and then of course you would need the European Parliament to ratify it, and then it would become a thing that would avoid a no-deal scenario. But of course, as you know, and as we've been reporting on the podcast here, simmering resentment, which has built up to furious anger over the withdrawal agreement, was meaning that more and more of her MPs were peeling away and promising to vote against the withdrawal agreement. Around at least 100 MPs on the Conservative side were going to vote against it. And then, of course, the Labour Party was against it, the DUP, Scottish Nationalists, almost everybody except the loyal members of her party. So even though there were a lot of strong signals on Monday morning and even on Sunday that the vote was going to go ahead, there were very dramatic moments on Monday morning when some media sources were saying, yes, it's definitely going ahead. And then I think Bloomberg was the outlet that said, no, the vote is going to be pulled. And that's exactly what happened. Gnashing of teeth, furious anger among both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party that the chance to vote on this withdrawal agreement had been denied MPs, and the whole situation fell into a tailspin. And I suppose it's worth reminding people how much the backstop is part of this whole picture. And it seemed to me that at a certain point it was no longer the backstop, it was the hated backstop. Why is that? Because the backstop, of course, according to the Conservative Party hardline interpretation, would trap the UK in a customs union or into the EU structures and orbit forever and a day. And this, of course, reflects the legal advice that Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, had given to MPs the previous week. And I think that really set things up for an almighty showdown in the House of Commons when the vote was going to be put to Parliament. It was clear to everybody that the vote was going to go down, that Theresa May would not be able to get the withdrawal agreement through the House of Commons. And then after that, there was a whole spaghetti of different permutations, none of them very pleasant looking or sounding as to what would happen next. Anything from a no-deal situation to a people's vote, a second referendum, to her somehow squeezing the thing through at the second or third attempt, perhaps a general election, perhaps Article 50 being revoked altogether. And of course, on Monday as well, let's not forget the European Court of Justice very conveniently ruled that the UK could revoke Article 50 if it so wanted. It wouldn't have to do. It wouldn't have to seek the consent of the European Union to do that. So all told, Monday was a pretty dramatic day in Brexit land.
On Tuesday, John Major, the former British Prime Minister, was in Dublin. He was advising the British government to do that very thing, to revoke the Article 50 withdrawal from the European Union and try and play for time, really, to calm the markets. He said time was in short supply. He was asked at that event whether or not a change in leadership of the Tory party was needed to try and bring new weight to whatever position the Tory party was trying to unite around, whether or not that a new leader would be helpful in that regard. And he said, look, the situation is difficult enough. I don't think a new leader or an attempt to get a new leader is going to help matters. And sure enough, by the middle of the week, there was an attempt to replace the leader.
Yeah, things were moving pretty quickly. So the vote was called off on Monday, and then there were dark forces moving at that point to try and topple her. The European Research Group, of course, the hardline faction in the House of Commons, which isn't incidentally very close to the DUP in the House of Commons, they started manoeuvres fairly quickly. I mean, it's the depth of feeling on Monday, I think, was extraordinary against Theresa May and against the backstop. I think it is worth pointing out yet again the reason why the Irish backstop, this fix to avoid a hard border on the island of Ireland, has encompassed this tidal wave of hatred in the Conservative ranks and elsewhere, is because of the UK-wide customs part of that backstop. And that, to remind people again, was what the UK itself asked for.
Because and which Theresa the European May, Union course, was pretty resistant to at the beginning. I mean, in a lot of our early podcasts, I think I asked the question several times of you, well, what's the objection to the UK request for a UK-wide backstop? And, I mean, you had a number of explanations, one of which was that Europeans felt that this was preempting the future relationship end of things. So they breached the future relationship, Dan, by allowing this to be included, and now it's not wanted on the UK end either.
Yeah, and the reason why things got so tricky was because basically the EU has seen Article 50 as comprising three key elements. One was to unscramble the important bits of the UK's membership of the EU. So it would be dealing with the financial settlement, how much they would have to pay to cover the commitments that they had made while they were members. The second thing was what they call the enduring commitments. So that was, you know, how do we deal with the issue of citizens' rights, EU citizens living in the UK, and vice versa. And of course, the biggest enduring commitment, according to the EU, that the UK had made was to the people of Ireland with the Good Friday Agreement. And the third part of the Article 50, according to the way the EU has interpreted it, is a bridge to the future. Now, when the UK came along and said, we want this UK-wide customs arrangement, but we want it to be temporary, they said, well, it can't be temporary because your formulation of this UK-wide customs thing doesn't fit into any of those three pillars within Article 50. And that was why things kind of broke down in October. You'll remember that they nearly had a deal before the October summit, but then it didn't work and they came out of the tunnel. But then they went back into the tunnel, the second tunnel, as they're calling it. But I think there were probably several tunnels and sort of micro tunnels. And the reason
your
they
moles
could get
are
things,
telling you this, presumably.
My moles are telling me all this exactly. as we were all digging deeper into this issue. There was a key moment, I think, between the two tunnels where the EU said, look, you know, you want this to be temporary. We will accept the temporary nature of this UK-wide customs arrangement, so long as it is the bridge to the future, and so long as this customs-wide, UK-wide customs thing, is actually something of a template for the UK's future relationship. So that's the bridge, in other words. And I think the task force really wanted to hear from the UK side saying, look, are you sure you guys want this? Because you know what this means. This will mean that you have to then orientate yourself for the future in a way that keeps you close to the customs union, because this is the only reason we're allowing you to get this into the Article 50 sort of framework. So that is why this thing has blown up as the hated backstop.
Well, is the Irish backstop then a misnomer? Because, or is the element of the Northern Irish backstop that lives within the backstop the objectionable part? I mean, what is... It has become known as the Irish backstop. There was some pretty heavy rhetoric in a BBC blog during the week as well, with people... A Tory MP saying the Irish really need to know their place on this. I mean, why the focus in Ireland?
Well, of course, at the very beginning of this process, when the EU responded to the triggering of Article 50, the Irish question was baked in. Now, I think it's always good in this understanding Brexit, it's always important to go back to the EU's kind of principled documents, and the way the EU saw Article 50 and Brexit was to see it in terms of avoiding a disorderly process. Basically, they were saying, look, okay, you voted to leave, that's your choice, but we are going to make sure that it does not damage the rest of the EU on the way out, on your way out. So it's like out the door, but mind the furniture on the way out, kind of thing. And so clearly one of the potential areas of real disorder was the Irish peace process. And of course, the reason the EU saw it in those terms was because the Irish government had made that case over and over again very effectively. So then it was the Irish issue, along with money and citizens' rights and so on. And then we got into this idea of the backstop. How do you avoid a hard border? How do you preserve the peace of the Good Friday Agreement? How do you preserve an all-island economy? All of the mesh of EU rules and regulations that facilitate North-South cooperation and so on. So it was at the beginning this kind of exotic, somewhat honorary issue at EU level. But then, of course, as we know, a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, it became the defining problem of Brexit. And then once the UK said, well, look, we can't abide by a Northern Ireland specific backstop because that would put a customs border on the Irish Sea, we then want this UK-wide entity. And that's why all of this problem has blown up the way it has.
Well, as people can probably hear, and as you said at the beginning, you're still at the summit. Arlene Foster wants the backstop gone. Theresa May wants clarification to help her sell, in essence, the withdrawal agreement, but the backstop within that. How far did she get with those endeavours at the two-day summit this week?
Well, of course, her mission began even in the first part of the week, because when she pulled the meaningful vote, she had to obviously give several reasons why. And in order to try and limit the damage and the pain, she said, well, look, I've listened to MPs. I understand that you don't like this withdrawal agreement. So I'm going to go off around Europe and seek some assurances about it to see, can we get some clarification, perhaps some legally binding commitments on the backstop? Because the real issue, as you know, we've been discussing, is this notion that the UK would be caught up in this thing forever and a day, that it would be indefinite. And as I've been explaining, that was kind of the price that the UK was accepting, and EU UK negotiators had willingly accepted when they moved into the second tunnel, that they would have to plot a trajectory which kept the UK close to the customs union and the single market.
Is part of this a function of how Theresa May has handled the negotiation? She's seen as somebody who, you know, didn't involve the successive Brexit secretaries, that a lot of it was a very tight relationship between her and Ollie Robbins, and maybe not seeking buy-in to what was going on in the tunnel or even before entry to the tunnel earlier, possibly sowed the seeds of this problem at this phase of things, notwithstanding the red lines she'd already established herself long before
I think you're right in a lot of that. I suppose if we take a step back and look at how she's managed this whole process from the beginning, she took over as leader and suddenly had to reinvent herself as a full-blooded Brexiteer in order to keep her party together. You know, she
having been a half-hearted Remainer.
From a half-hearted Remainer to a full-blooded Brexiteer. So she filled her cabinet with quite a few Brexiteers like David Davis, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson as Foreign Secretary. And she had, you know, a fairly, you know, robust, unambiguous message for the grassroots and party members. You'll remember her famous party conference speech in October 2016, where she said Brexit means Brexit and we're going to make a success of it. She wasn't just recording that.
We remind everybody at the beginning of this podcast.
She didn't just say that for our podcast. She said it for the grassroots, and we thank her for it. But then, you know, I think once the reality of the negotiations and the reality of the Irish border problem began to bite, and I think this time last year was a real shock for the British system. They had kind of figured that rhetoric and aspiration would solve the Irish border problem. Every British senior cabinet minister, Theresa May herself, when asked, would say, of course, we don't want a hard border. We don't want a return to violence. We want to preserve the achievements and goals of the Good Friday Agreement. But when they were asked, well, how are you going to do that if you have these red lines of being out of the customs union, union and single market, they didn't really have an answer. And then when they were kind of frog marched into backstop land by the EU and Ireland and said, look, you've got to get real about this, you've got to get serious, that's when the gap between her rhetoric to the party and the grassroots and what was being acknowledged and admitted to by people like Ollie Robbins in her negotiating team, that gap got wider and wider, and eventually it was just not sustainable. And in the end, that's really why this mess is the way it is. If she had leveled with people at the start about how painful Brexit was going to be, how profound the challenges for the Irish border were, then perhaps people would have internalized those in Westminster. But again, perhaps not. Perhaps it would have. It would never have happened. Who knows?
It's kind of funny, isn't it? Because Winston Churchill is often invoked on the Brexiteer side of things. But I mean, at least he leveled with people when he said, "I have nothing to offer but blood, sweat, toil, and tears." If I think if I got that right, she never made a speech like that.
No, she didn't. Her speeches were inclined to talk about taking back control of borders, money, and laws, and we're going to make a success of it. And even in the depths of her week of the dark night of the soul this week, she would talked about a brighter future just around the corner for the British people if they would only just adopt this withdrawal treaty. But anyway, to get back to her her European tour.
You're thinking of Napoleon, I think.
I think Napoleon had probably an easier time of it getting to Moscow.
In Russia,
Her mission was to try and get some kind of promises or anything at all from the EU side that would allow her to convince the party and the House of Commons that this backstop was not going to be forever. And now I think that a lot happened this week, so let's sort of stick to the key moments.
Yeah.
She had a meeting here in Brussels with Donald Tusk on Tuesday evening, and at that meeting she said she would want the backstop to be applying only for a year, And Donald Tusk must have looked at her as if she was mad, because that was absolutely not going to be ever acceptable to the EU or in general, or to the Irish government in particular. So she then asked, as far as sources tell me, she then asked for a two-step process so that at the summit she would get some political reassurances, and then she would come back in January and get some legal reassurances. And then we started to have a bit of a feeding frenzy as to what legal declarations she might get. And there is a whole lucky bag of EU mechanisms and legal tools that can provide some kind of help for getting a difficult treaty over the line. The most notable ones would be, of course, the EU-Canada deal, the CETA trade agreement, which of course was held up by the tiny Wallonia region in Belgium. They got a joint interpretative instrument, which basically was
what
binding between the... It's Article 31 of the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. And this was basically dug up to... I'm sure you haven't got that far when you've been reading the Vienna Convention.
No, I was just actually enjoying the "I'm glad you asked me that" tone of your voice. But go on anyway.
I have a whole team of researchers here doing all this kind of thing for me. No, but seriously, she... So this was an idea that was used to get the CETA agreement over the line, and basically it binds both parties to a common interpretation of what a treaty means. It doesn't change the treaty, but it just basically, it's both sides saying we have signed this treaty, and this is what we understand the treaty to mean.
Okay.
So obviously the Wallonians in the French-speaking part of Belgium were worried about about public procurement, we're worried about environmental standards, we're worried about whether or not big corporations could override governments and so on. So all
of
these things were
kind of... So it applies a single meaning to the way in which a document can be interpreted, and it states explicitly what words mean. Would that be
so
correct?
So with the CETA agreement, they picked out all the sensitive areas and gave them each several paragraphs, and both sides were then able to say, well, this is what this means in layman's terms. And then that was binding on both parties, the EU and Canada. Now, the difference there, of course, was that CETA had to be ratified by everybody, and Wallonia was holding it up, so there was a real pressing urgency to get that. The other issue that they were looking at, or the other model they were looking at, was a declaration that the Netherlands got for getting the EU-Ukraine Association Agreement over the line in the Dutch Parliament. Now, there was a referendum there which the Dutch lost, and again, they looked for this way out of it. Now, that took the Dutch a year, and the big difference there was that Mark Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister, was able to go to the EU and say, look, if you can get me this legally binding declaration, I can deliver you the Dutch Parliament. And
now, when you say legally binding, what article does this come under, or what's the format? So it's not just a political declaration, is that right? It's something more.
Well,
that
was a more legally binding declaration. That was, as far as I'm aware, now I could be corrected on this, but as far as I'm aware, that was lodged as a legal document in the UN, and it was, I think it was also going to be sort of transferred into the treaty at a certain point. We can look at the Irish model as well, actually, because you'll remember when the Lisbon Treaty was rejected, the Irish government then negotiated three protocols on taxation, neutrality, and social issues, for which we read abortion. And those were legally binding protocols which were then lodged in the UN, and then they were later incorporated into the EU treaties. And
Croatia acceded then. They said the next time we have a treaty, we'll bundle
this
in, leave it with us, we're good for this.
Exactly, yeah. Okay. So that then gave the Irish government a case to go back to the people, which they did, and of course the Lisbon Treaty was passed on the second attempt. So none of these are really good fits for the British situation. And I have to say that, this week the Irish government were quite nervous about any kind of legal protocol or declaration. They were quite happy to give political clarification to Theresa May, but not anything that was going to be a legal thing. And more specifically, if you have a legal protocol that is attached to the withdrawal agreement, the Irish view legally was that that was akin and tantamount to opening that treaty, the withdrawal agreement. And the mantra all week here in Brussels was, we're going to provide you with any all the clarification you need, but the treaty itself cannot be reopened and renegotiated.
There's also not an incentive on the European side, as you were saying there before I interrupted you. Mark Rutte, when he went to them over Ukraine, had the heft to be able to say, I can get this through Parliament. When the Irish Taoiseach during Nice and Lisbon went to Europe, they said, look, here are the issues that arose in the referendum. We reckon we could get this through if you clarify these. Theresa May comes back. She has 200 votes on her side in Parliament, 117 of her own party against her, 257 Labour MPs who are committed to bringing about a general election, 35 SNP who aren't in favour of even leaving the European Union, and 10 DUP who don't like the backstop. So in essence, it's 200 versus 450 in the House of Commons. Why would Europe give anything to a leader who's only going to be there for 12 months and can't command a majority now?
Yeah, exactly. And I think this all kind of became part of the whole mess here at the summit, which, as you can hear, is just ending. When she came over. So she came over yesterday in the hope of getting some kind of legally binding or politically binding commitments. And she had basically an hour to make her pitch to EU leaders last night in the summit. So she would make her case for some changes or some clarification. And then EU leaders by themselves would talk about this. Now, there was a bit of a preamble to this because, first of all, this has been sprung quite suddenly. Of course, nobody was expecting the vote to be pulled necessarily, and the EU works at a much slower pace in terms of the process of having a summit. So normally summits are examples of issues that are pre-cooked, deeply prepared by officials, by ambassadors, by ministers, so that when EU leaders get to grips with the subject in hand at a summit, they don't have to get bogged down in negotiating details with their counterparts. They give it a much loftier political gloss and endorsement. But because this had been sprung on the EU so suddenly earlier this week, what they did was the Commission and the Council got together and drew up a six-paragraph document or statement, which was basically not so much a pre-cooked conclusion, but it was more of a framework for discussion. So most of the paragraphs in this statement were in square brackets, meaning they were open to be changed by the leaders themselves. So it was quite an unusual situation for unprecedented at Article 50 level. In the Brexit process, for leaders themselves to be sitting around a table saying, actually, that paragraph there, we'll take that out or we'll move that sentence around a bit.
It's normally more at a more advanced stage of the cookery.
Yeah, exactly. It's like buying a Marks & Spencer's pre-cooked meal and then enjoying it with a glass of wine.
Was more like a bag of carrots and an onion and a bag of mince.
Yeah, and a menu, or a recipe book.
And some grapes to make your own wine.
Some grapes, exactly. So that was the kind of, the context of this meeting. Now, the six paragraphs in the statement basically started by saying the withdrawal agreement is negotiated, we're not reopening it. But then there was language saying that the EU will negotiate a free trade agreement as quickly as possible so that we may never need the backstop. Then there was language to the effect that the backstop is not a desirable outcome. And then later on, I think the fifth paragraph talked about the EU stands ready to provide further assurances. Now, this was basically the two-step idea that Theresa May had looked for: political assurances at the summit, then legal assurances in January, just before the House goes back to vote on this withdrawal agreement. That was the state of play when the summit started yesterday. It began actually with a a meeting between Theresa May and Leo Varadkar, which I'm told was quite a frosty meeting.
Oh, really?
In the end.
Right.
Quite a long meeting, yeah. Officials on the Irish side were not really saying much about it, but other sources were saying that it was not the best meeting. Quite long, but I think the Irish side
probably felt longer.
And they talked a lot about the idea of speeding up a free trade agreement in order to avoid the backstop ever taking effect. Now, I think the Irish still feel quite sore about the fact that Theresa May is coming back, trying to open things up, trying to renegotiate things after the government had finally, after 2 years, got its precious backstop locked into the withdrawal agreement. It now seemed that that it wasn't quite that simple, and I think they were nervous about these legal promises and so on. But it seems in essence that Theresa May almost exclusively focused her discussion with the Taoiseach on some way of speeding up the free trade agreement that would then prove to the world and prove to her party in the House of Commons that you wouldn't need to have the backstop because this free trade agreement was going to take over and solve everybody's problems. Now, just to remind people of the sequencing here, that Britain leaves at the end of March. You have a two-year transition period. They can extend that by another 2 years if necessary. And then you've got the backstop kind of hovering over that. So Theresa May obviously wants to use all as much time as possible to get the free trade deal done so the backstop is never needed. And then what happened last night after the meeting with Leo Varadkar, she went in to make her pitch. And one of the things that she tried to do was to take the political declaration, which is, as we know, an aspirational sidebar to the withdrawal agreement, and actually say, well, why don't we add that to the withdrawal treaty as an annex and give it legal weight? So the promises in the political declaration about using best endeavours to never have to use the backstop and so on, that it would then suddenly, overnight, be given the legal weight of the withdrawal agreement.
Right.
And I think
how long was the shrift
leaders,
given to that?
Leaders, it was about a millimetre shrift-wise, very right. short in the shrift department.
Okay.
but leaders were actually quite amazed at the fact that she would pitch this for two reasons. One was that this had apparently been floated in the tunnel, but Michel Barnier said that's just out of the question. You know, that is just you're trying something on there that's never going to fly. And I think leaders, see, not all the 27 leaders are as au fait with what goes on in the tunnel as Leo Varadkar would be, and people like you and I would be. and they were simply going like, how is that going to work? And secondly, they were also saying, you know, you need, as the British Prime Minister, you need to be winning over the man in the street in the UK, and you're telling us that you want to put this thing here into an annex connected to that thing there. I mean, you need to have some idea as to how you're going to win over your MPs and the general public. And the other thing then was that she was saying, well, if we can't have an expiry date for the backstop, why don't we have a deadline for the free trade agreement? So let's say the free trade agreement has to be negotiated by the end of December 2020. And again, I think EU leaders were amazed.
What difference would that make? I mean, if you set a deadline, what do you still need a mechanism in order to come into play if that deadline is not met, and deadlines aren't met, like TTIP never came to be. And
I mean, the idea that you can fix a hard deadline for a trade negotiation is for the birds, frankly, and I think EU leaders realised that last night. And the other thing that they were kind of resentful of was that it would have meant that, you know, if that deadline was missed, then the UK could blame the EU for dragging its heels in the trade negotiations, and it would suddenly push the burden of getting this thing done quickly over to the EU side. So that was never going to fly. So I think that soured the mood quite a bit last night, and for that reason, it seems like the issues kind of hardened in the room when Theresa May left. And what happened was, this idea that you know, the EU stands ready for further assurances, that paragraph was summarily dropped, not just because of Irish objections, but it basically didn't survive for very long in the room. And so that's why all of the headlines this morning on Friday morning were Theresa May rebuffed, her pleas were rejected, and then you had this
the nebulous
bizarre
thing.
Row over the nebulous. So for those who haven't been watching it in such detail, what happened was that in his news conference late on Thursday night, Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the Commission, complained that the presentation was kind of nebulous for the reasons that I have been setting out, that you know, Theresa May was looking for these unworkable technical fixes and also not really getting to grips with, you know, what she was looking for. I mean, again, to get back to this idea of a deadline for the free trade agreement, the EU keeps saying to the British side, look, do you realise that, you know, if you want a free trade agreement that avoids a hard border in Ireland, you're going to have very high alignment on customs and single market rules, and yet the British public have not had that conversation. The British system has not in any way metabolized that, not at a broad popular level or even at a political level in the House of Commons, and yet, you know, you're making this pitch at the 11th hour. So that's why I think Jean-Claude Juncker talked about this thing being nebulous.
Now, he walked it back a bit.
That was reported in the British press.
He walked
well,
it back
yeah,
a bit
so
today.
That was reported in the British. That was reported in the papers this morning, and then there was a very graphic image of Theresa May challenging Jean-Claude Juncker when the leaders were doing the round table, as they call it, the tour de table, before the meeting begins today, Friday, and Theresa May is clearly upbraiding Jean-Claude Juncker about this thing, saying, you know, did you call me nebulous? And she, I mean, to me, she looked angry, almost to the point of tears. You could see President Juncker trying to mollify her, and there was a lot of hand on the forearm kind of thing. That wasn't me, I didn't do that. Then at a news conference later, he said, yeah, he did. Well, he was asked about it, of course, and he said, well, he'd used the word nebuleux in French, which means foggy. He did not know there was a word, such a word, nebulous, in English. And he said that he was talking about the lack of debate in the UK about this. And Theresa May appears to have accepted his assurances. And I think it did, again, highlight an interesting thing that we've seen in the summit this week, that one leader after another has said, you know, the House of Commons, Westminster, really has to get its act together on this. And I think after what happened yesterday, there were people who were saying, look, Theresa May did her best. She made a good presentation. It's Westminster that has to get its act together and figure out what it wants from this Brexit process.
Well, just to impinge on your time a bit more on a long day, while all of this stuff was going on in the UK and, you know, the leadership and everything else, in Brussels, are people beginning to price in increasingly a view that Theresa May is just not going to get this across the line and there may need to be other? Are they people taking a view that nothing will happen until after a general election? Are people putting things on hold for the 12 months that Theresa May is there? What's the kind of sense of people, as the markets say, pricing in Theresa May to their considerations on how Brexit will go forward?
I suppose the all of that attempt by the EU to, you know, crystal ball gaze or surmise or factor in or price in, it's kind of bracketed by the fact that a no deal scenario is worse for the UK than for the rest of Europe, notwithstanding Ireland, of course, and that, you know, there is simply no way that the EU is going to reopen the negotiating text and the withdrawal treaty. So they probably believe that when it comes down to it, Britain will simply not choose a no deal option. And the alternatives, as we know, are, of course, are either revoking Article 50 altogether or looking for an extension to Article 50, or signing the withdrawal agreement, or having a general election or something of that nature. But of course, you know, the people here are just as at sea when you try to sit down and figure out the permutations in the House of Commons, in the Labour Party. A lot of talk here about what Labour will do, whether they have an idea about timing a second referendum proposal. You know, at what point does there become a critical mass within the Labour ranks for a second referendum? And when, where that timing fits in to the House of Commons vote, and the fact that the clock will be ticking. I think the way people here are interpreting what Theresa May is doing is, in a sense, even though she's saying today, well, we're still going to keep talking about assurances and discussions will continue, I think people regard her as just playing for time, trying to get this over the line, not over the line, but trying to pause this for Christmas, that, you know, people will simply take a break from it, and then, you know, cooler heads might prevail in January. But there's no appetite here, I can tell you, for another summit in January to have more of the same kind of conversation. So, you know, all eyes now are on what she can do at Westminster, whether they can somehow get this over the line. But it's really hard to say after this week. You know, the humiliation of the confidence vote, the humiliation or setback in Brussels, it's very hard to see her winning over the party in sufficient numbers to get this across the line in January in the House of Commons.
And is that, in conclusion, the next set piece, really, as far as the outlook over the next next few weeks goes? Is it really pause for Christmas and then the frantic activity starts again in the lead up to the January 21st deadline on the meaningful vote?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. She is she's got to try and figure out what to do. Her party have to figure out what to do. The Labour Party have to work out their strategy. At EU level on Wednesday next, they're going to be presenting their latest document on the No Deal planning. I suspect a fairly edifying and forensic look at what No Deal will mean across a range of sectors, and again the message from the Commission will be member states have to prepare for this, and the Commission will set the framework for that, and again that will probably cast a shadow on how things unfold in London in January.
Right, well look, as they dismantle the summit infrastructure around you there, we let you go, and thanks very much for all of that analysis there this evening. But that's it from me, Colm O'Mungain, here in Dublin.
Yeah, and that's it from me, Tony Connolly, and I guess this will be our last podcast of 2018. What a year it's been. The year that launched Brexit Republic, the podcast du jour, podcast of choice for lots of people. Long may it continue, and thank you for listening all year since June, and we look forward to more Brexit Republic in 2019.
Hear, hear.